The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. This week, I participated in an event sponsored by the George Washington University chapter of the Federalist Society on NSA surveillance programs, Edward Snowden, Congress, and the FISA court. The event was styled as a debate between me and Lawfare's Steve Vladek, moderated by GW's esteemed Fourth Amendment scholar Orrin Kerr. But it turned out to be not so much of a debate as a discussion, which Orrin not only moderated, but contributed insights of his own to as well. It was actually one of the best discussions of this subject I have been involved in, both in terms of isolating the areas genuinely under dispute and in terms of constructive engagement over them. It is long for the Lawfare podcast, running nearly an hour and 20 minutes, but many listeners will find it worthwhile.
Thank you all for coming, whether it's for the food or if you're interested in the subject, either way. So I'm really delighted to be able to host this discussion between Benjamin Wittes, Steve Vladek, and myself. This is an idea that I put together, the idea for this panel, because I wanted to hear from Benjamin Wittes, Steve Vladek, about their views of the NSA surveillance stories and the legal implications and the policy implications. So I'm really excited. Let me just briefly introduce them. Benjamin Wittes is to my right, to your left, is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also the editor-in-chief of the Lawfare blog, which is really a fantastic blog on national security law. Very recently, Glenn Greenwald, who you're probably all familiar with, is the author of some of the stories in The Guardian disclosing the documents by Edward Snowden, described Benjamin Wittes as, quote, a hardcore apologist for NSA abuses, but recognized that he usually employs a Brookings-type civil tone, which is quite an endorsement of Wittes' significance and role in these debates. On my left, your right, Professor Steve Vladek of American University, where he is the Associate Dean for Scholarship. He also writes for the Lawfare blog and is now an editor-in-chief of a new blog, Just Security, which is going to be a terrific blog, just get started last week, on also on national security law. So we were going to start, Mr. Wittes was going to offer kind of his summary of the facts. We wanted to make sure we all understand the basic facts involved in the NSA surveillance stories, because there are a lot of moving pieces. Once we get the facts out, we'll then turn to what our reaction is and should be. So, start with the facts.
Thanks. I will try to maintain a Brookings-type civil tone, but I may get really pissed off because I might deviate from it.
I haven't even started talking yet.
So the facts actually in this are numerous and extremely complicated. And so I'm going to try to distill them down to about 5 minutes. But I want to say with a caveat up front that it actually is kind of hard to do that in a way that's not reductionist, and so I'm going to be reductionist. Broadly speaking, there are two major clusters of facts that have been disclosed in the context of this wave of leaks and official disclosures that followed the leaks. There are a lot of other issues that have come out as well, but they don't tend to raise the same sort of, haven't generated the same sort of legal discussions, and they haven't involve the same density of material. And so for now, I'm going to bracket them aside and focus only on A, the leak and the subsequent disclosures related to Section 215 bulk metadata collection, which is to say the bulk collection of records related to the fact and time and numbers on either end of people's phone calls, which the government has confirmed has been collecting domestically for quite a number of years now. And number two, collection of foreign communications under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. And this is an entirely different program that, unlike the 215 material, involves the contents of communications, mainly internet, but also telephony communications. So let's start with 215. This is the broadest of overviews, and each of the things I'm about to say could itself spark an hour of conversation. Broadly speaking, the government has been collecting all domestic metadata. It's been collecting it from the companies, the telecommunications carriers. It has been collecting it under orders of the FISA court based on the provision of the FISA that grants it the authority to order companies to produce tangible things to the extent that those things are relevant to an authorized national security investigation. It has been putting this database, these metadata, in what you might think of as a lockbox of database that it accesses when and only when, at least it's supposed to access when and only when. It has a phone identifier that is associated to a certain level of predication with terrorist activity. When it does so, it can figure out what other numbers that phone number has contacted, and it can then figure out what numbers those numbers have contacted, and it can do that up to three what are called hops from the original number. This relies, I think it's fair to say, on an interpretation of Section 215 that is plausible but by no means obvious, and has received a lot of criticism from, among other people, the two people sitting next to me. And I have questioned it myself. It is also the case that at least 14 federal judges have issued orders based on this theory, so it has a certain acceptance on the part of the judiciary, at least that part of the FISA judiciary that has heard the government's theory. And it is also the case that Congress has reauthorized the statute twice, knowing full well of the substance of the government's position, though it is fair to say that individual members in fairly large numbers have professed that they were not adequately briefed as to the contours of the government's position. So there's a bit of a contested set of facts as to who knew what when these provisions were reauthorized, both in 2010 and in 2011. The 702 program is, I think it's fair to say, a simpler matter legally and a more complicated matter technically. We know less about it, but basically the law, Section 702, allows the government to order, with a FISA court order, companies to produce call contents to the extent, and communications contents, to the extent that the targets of the communications are reasonably believed to be overseas. The basic contours of the program is that the government has done that assiduously and aggressively, and has gotten a great deal of cooperation from major communications providers, internet companies, and has collected a very, very large body of information. I think I'll stop there. But I guess the one additional component of that is that there have been significant questions raised as to whether the targeting and minimization procedures that the government uses when it does that are adequate to exclude or get rid of U.S. person communications that everybody agrees they are not supposed to have. So that's the, sort of the highest level altitude overview I can give. And now Steve will tell you all the things that I should have included in it and left out.
No, I mean, I don't think you omitted anything. I just want to illuminate this with a couple more data points. So I think it's important. I assume we don't all know the full history of FISA, you know, backwards and forwards. So I think it's worth saying 30 seconds on where this all came from, right? So FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, and as originally enacted, the idea behind FISA was to put onto a legal footing surveillance that had hitherto been conducted largely beyond the law. Or at least largely beyond judicial review. And so one of the things that FISA does is it creates the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FIS Court, the FISA Court. And at least when it was initially created in 1978, what the FISA Court was doing was something that looked a lot like warrants applications, right? So the government would go to the FISA Court, the government would say, we have probable cause to believe not that Professor Kerr is committed a crime, but that he's an agent of a foreign power. Right, and if in fact the FISA court agreed, they'd issue what was basically a search warrant. You know, there are some sort of differences in the margins, but it was sort of modeled on ordinary search warrants in the criminal context. The real expansions in the role of the FISA court came with the two authorities that Ben describes. Right, so in 2001, as part of the Patriot Act, Congress passed Section 215, the provision at the center of the telephone and metadata program. And 215 now says the FISA court's not just going to do warrants, they're also going to do production orders, right? They're going to issue orders to third parties, to businesses, to other companies to produce records, right? And so one of the questions is, what kinds of records were encompassed within Section 215? So now the FISA court's not just doing warrant applications, now the FISA court is also handling what really is a form of an administrative subpoena, which is different in kind from what it was originally set out to do. Fast forward to 2008, the FISA Amendments Act, which adds Section 702, now the FISA court's not just doing warrants and administrative subpoenas, now they're also reviewing what are called certifications, right? So under Section 702, the government files a very thorough certification with the FISA court that it is conducting these interceptions for up to a year, that it is targeting non-citizens outside the U.S., and that is at least purportedly taking steps to minimize the impact on communications of protected persons. So one of the important pieces of this conversation is not just the fight over the authorities, but the way in which the role of the FISA court has actually changed and, I think, arguably expanded over time. Two other quick points. First, one of the important facts about both of the authorities Ben mentioned, Section 215 and Section 702, is Congress also included with them the right of the recipient of such an order to challenge it, to pursue judicial review of that order. So if you receive a Section 215 order, if you're Verizon, if you receive a Section 702 certification, if you're Google, right, you have a statutory right to challenge it in the FISA court. One of the things we learned, one of the most important things in my view, that we learned from the disclosures this summer is that no one has ever done that. Right, that no recipient of a 215 order, no recipient of a 702 certification has ever invoked the judicial review that's available. And we can talk about why and what that means going forward. Last, right, and this is, I think, an important fact from my perspective, although Ben may think it just colored my view. Right, one of the opinions that was disclosed this summer, an opinion by Judge John Bates, documented in a footnote, footnote 14, three different occasions where the government had affirmatively misled the FISA court about the scope of what the NSA was doing. And one of those occasions involved the telephone and metadata program, right? And so I think from a sort of credibility and trust perspective, part of the issue here is that the FISA court is often relying upon government representations that we now know, thanks to these disclosures, were incorrect on at least three occasions, perhaps even more. And then the last very small point, we tend to think this is all about Snowden, right, that Snowden caused all of this. A part of these disclosures have also been the result of very aggressive FOIA litigation by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And so I think it's just important to keep in mind this is not all Snowden. Some of this is actually stuff that might have come out this summer anyway. So that's the only stuff I would add.
Terrific. Okay, so those are the basic facts. Let's turn to the reaction to those facts. The description of the panel was, should we be angry about the disclosures of what the NSA was doing, and if so, at whom? So let's address that question starting with that.
So one of the things about this, I think, is that almost everybody's mad about it. People are either mad that there were these disclosures, or they're mad at the substance of what's in the disclosures, or both. And the both are some of the most interesting characters, actually, in the whole drama. I think the question of who you're mad at is going to be largely a function, I want to say, of three or four separate questions. And rather than telling you who I'm mad at, I'm just going to tick out those questions. One is how you feel about leakers and whistleblowers, and that's a larger conversation. Snowden is a very interesting character in this, and one of the interesting things about him is that he did not take the material in question to any of the known processes by which we handle whistleblowing and handle disclosures about improper or allegedly improper conduct in government. What he did is he packed them abroad and went to two countries that are, shall we say, not exactly friendly to U.S. interests, and by the way, have active intelligence services that operate in a fashion that the U.S. government regards as hostile a lot of the time, and proceeded to give that information in very large quantities. It's probably about 50,000 pages altogether to journalists. So this is from the point of view of somebody who I've never worked in government, and I'm not one of the people who has a sort of personal sense of affront at that. In fact, my background is in the press, and I've solicited my share of leaks in my life. This is a very aggressive form of whistleblowing, and I think it makes a lot of people very deeply uncomfortable. So that's axis number one. Axis number two is, there is a big spiritual divide in these questions as to how you feel about data that is collected but not exploited. And I think there's a never the twain shall meet quality here. One side says, okay, the government's collected all the metadata in the world, but they're only querying it under these very narrow conditions, and they're not exploiting it for any purpose other than, very narrow counterterrorism purposes, and they've only done it 300 times last year. I forget what the exact number is. So what harm does that do anybody who isn't, in fact, subject of reasonable predication for querying that database? And I count myself as one of this group, by the way, see the civil liberties infringement there as almost entirely hypothetical and inconsequential. The other group, and I just think this is a sort of almost spiritual difference that is very hard to bridge, sees the fact of collection itself as a very deep affront to our constitutional traditions in the absence of predication for the collection. Now that raises a whole set of questions that I'm not going to address about the state of constitutional law in this space, but suffice it to say that there's a lot of people for whom, if you believe that the collection itself is inoffensive and the disclosure is very offensive, you're going to be very differently angry than if you're not particularly offended by the disclosure of government secrets and you believe that the collection is illegal. So I think those are the sort of major questions. There are some others, but I think those are the sort of major questions along which people are kind of deciding who they're angry at. One other thing, I think a lot of people are feeling betrayed by the communications companies that are actually cooperating with the government on this. Steve raised a very important point before in terms of why these companies are not availing themselves of judicial review. They actually have the option of doing that. There's a very simple reason for it, which is that they don't care. The only thing they care about is that they're producing this material under judicial compulsion. So that they're not voluntarily giving up your data. So the moment the FISA court orders them to produce this material, their view is fine. And they have no reason to appeal this. And a lot of people feel very betrayed by that because they feel like those companies are the only stand-in, they're the only party with standing to challenge these orders, and it's just not in their interest to do it. Well, they're the only party currently. I think depending on how you feel about those questions, you will be very angry at very different parties, but you'll probably be angry at somebody.
So my list of who I'm angry at. So let me start by saying I'm not angry at the executive branch. Because I think this is going to sound probably somewhat crazy coming from someone like me, but I actually think it's the job of the executive branch to push the envelope. It's Madison's point about separation of powers, that, ambition begets ambition. And so I think one should not be pissed off that the executive branch is pursuing zealous interpretations of its authorities. Misrepresenting its authorities, slightly different problem. So here's who I actually think we should be pissed off at. Congress. That's easy these days, right? Who is not pissed off at Congress right now? But in two very specific respects. First, Ben and I are going to fight about just how much Congress knew and when Congress knew it. But it's clear that at least some members of Congress knew something and did nothing. And now that it's out, they're like, oh my God, this is horrible. If only we had known. I don't really buy that. And the other piece of this is, keep in mind that there used to be a provision of the Federal Telecommunications Act that barred telecom companies from turning over your data to the government without a warrant. Congress repealed that in 2005 as part of the telecom immunity post-Bush warrantless wiretapping solution. So number one, Congress. Number two, the FISA court. These judges have a very hard job, but I think they have been under-imaginative in thinking about how to do their job. So they have the power to ask for help from amici. Right, they have the power to request that outside security cleared lawyers come and help them sort through these hard issues. They've never done it. I mean, they've done it once, and it was 9 years ago. And so you have people like Judge Robertson and Judge Carr, former judges on the FISA court, who have both now said publicly, if only there were provisions that allowed us to seek the guidance, the adversarial briefing about, they had that possibility. They had that power. They just never used it. Number three, Justice Alito. In February of 2013, Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion for a 5-4 court in Clapper versus Amnesty International, a suit that was challenging and interprets the very real concern that the government was using Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act in the exact way it turns out they were. And Justice Alito wrote an opinion in February 2013 that says, unless these plaintiffs can show that the interception of their communications was certainly impending, they don't have standing to pursue their claim. I think that's an interesting timing issue. Fourth, Ben's pointed out the recipients of Section 215 and 702 orders. I think these guys actually probably have a statutory obligation to perhaps try to act in the interest of their customers. Ben's right about why they didn't. That doesn't mean that I should be happy with it. Fifth, the New York Giants. that was a different panel, sorry. And then last, at some point I suspect we're going to talk about the Fourth Amendment. And in that regard, I think it's telling to look at the Jones GPS case from a couple of years ago. So if you guys remember this case, right, the police put a GPS device on this guy's car, followed him around for 27, 28 days. The Supreme Court unanimously holds that was a search. But the majority, in an opinion by Justice Scalia, said that it was a search only because it was a physical intrusion, right? That by placing the GPS device on this guy's car, that was invading, that was basically trespassing on his property. The concurrent opinion, and here Justice Alito redeems himself in my book, the concurrent opinion said, no, what's different about this case is not the physical trespass, it's the extent of the surveillance. It's the fact that the government was in a position over a period of 27 days to follow this guy around in a way that none of us would have. unless you're really creepy and have a strange way of viewing your law school homework. Right? And I think this is, you know, the question, the real Fourth Amendment question that's lurking behind both 215 and 702 is something called the third party doctrine. And whether we really have no expectation of privacy in information that we turn over to third parties. Well, the concurring opinion in Jones suggests that maybe when the government is the only party in a position to aggregate data that might be available to other third parties, that might not be true. They don't hold that, it's just a concurring opinion, right? But had that actually been the holding, had that been sort of the basis for revisiting the Smith third party doctrine, I think the constitutional concerns here would be a lot more powerful. So, you know, I have a lot of angst.
Fair enough. I wanted to focus on I guess the second of your list, the role of the FISA court here. Because I wonder if the story specifically with regard to Section 215 surveillance isn't a story of the FISA court not playing the role it's supposed to. In the sense that if you read Section 215, it says the government has an order, has an ability, a power, to compel tangible things, to obtain tangible things, when there is reason to believe that the tangible thing would be relevant to a national security investigation. And granted, tangible things includes, and there's a little parenthetical, it includes records, so interesting question of whether that only means tangible records or intangible records. But on its face, I don't think you'd look at that language and think, oh, well, that allows the government to get everyone's call records in the United States and look through those call records. I don't understand how you can get from the text to that result. Now, the best explanation for how you get there was recently offered by a former Assistant Attorney General, David Chris, who's now in the private sector. But the argument for how you get there requires, as Ben suggested, some leaps that are not exactly intuitive. And so there's the technical legal argument, and I find it, I'm unpersuaded, I should say, by that argument. But even if you're persuaded by that argument, it requires kind of a secret law. It requires a statute that looks like it's doing one thing to be interpreted by a secret court to do something quite different. And from a standpoint of public accountability, that I find that very troubling. In part because when the FISA court rules on a surveillance power, it is setting a default. And when the FISA court says the government can do something, it's changing the default power that makes it very difficult for that clock or that bell to be unrung. In the following sense, it's when we regulate in the area of national security law, the government always has a very significant advantage. That is, the president that is behind the national security state is also the person who has veto power under the Constitution. So the president has, there's always kind of a pressure to expand the law, expand government power, and it's one that is difficult to overcome. So if the default secretly changes, what that means is that the courts effectively are expanding government power in a way that's quite difficult to undo, even if the public learns of what the program is that has been approved. So we had, you know, until the disclosures, we didn't know that that was the program that was disclosed. So it was all going secretly. But now that we know, let's say you don't want that to be the law. Well, before the FISA court interpreted Section 215 to allow this program, I don't think the president could have gotten it pushed through Congress. I think there's sufficient opposition to it that the law, that the pre-existing statutory laws, which you would have naturally read to say you can't do this, I don't think Congress would have changed it to explicitly allow this program. And yet, now that the program was approved in secret by the FISA court, I think it's also going to be quite difficult for Congress to change the law, to go back to what we would have thought the law was beforehand. So I wonder if the FISA court, by adopting what may or may not be a plausible interpretation of the law, but a law that you would, an interpretation you wouldn't get just from reading the statute, I wonder if they haven't really sort of completely undone the purpose of the FISA court, which was to introduce a judicial role that would be based on some sort of publicly accountable standard of what the government is allowed to do and not allowed to do. So I guess I'm gonna turn this into my question for Ben, which is, should we be disappointed in the FISA court for its interpretation of the law?
It's a very hard question, and I suppose that may imply that the answer to it is yes. But let me say the following. First of all, I think the it's not quite as big a leap as it may seem, or you may have just presented it. Which isn't to say there aren't some leaps in it. But you say,
a series of little leaps.
I think it's more of a series of little leaps than a series of big leaps. The statute authorizes the acquisition of tangible things when they are reasonably expected to be relevant to a counterterrorism investigation. So I suppose one thing is, of course, whether the records in question are tangible. But I think, electronic records get produced all the time. And so that actually troubles me a lot less than the relevance issue. And the real question here is, to me, is can you order, based on the tangible things statute, the production of haystacks because they will contain needles?
Because they might contain needles.
Because they might contain needles. And can you order the production of haystacks that involve hay that haven't yet been grown, and much less bound, because they may involve, somebody may inject a needle into one of them. Now, if you ask me that as an original matter, I would say there are definitely some leaps in that. And when I read that order, my first reaction, which I wrote in a Bangkok airport, on jumping on a plane without realizing that Oren was writing more or less exactly the same thing at exactly the same time, was that would make any data set relevant to any investigation, and that sort of can't be right. I think the other side of that is that the statute is capaciously worded. And so the government tried, and it got an order, and that does create a momentum of its own. So I guess if the question is, do I think that that is the optimal reading of the statute, the answer is probably not. Am I comfortable with it? No. But here's the other side. I am persuaded that bulk metadata collection, in the basic form in which the government is doing it, is probably a good and necessary thing. And so the conclusion I draw from that is less outrage than it is, boy, we need a more tailored statute that in fact describes what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think what we're doing is we're acquiring this data under very restrictive conditions because we consider it necessary. The relevant issue, no pun intended, is actually not relevance. The relevant issue is necessity, that it is believed, and I believe it, that this data provides a very important source of information for a certain set of investigations, and that we do not want to not have it. And so a lot of what is being packed into an argument about relevance is really an argument about utility and necessity. And I think we would be a lot better off if Congress would simply pass a bulk metadata authorization statute that authorized and limited what we're doing here. And the result being that, a lot of what you're translating into irritation at the FISA court for this position, which would then unfortunately lead to Congress inevitably doing X, Y, and Z, I kind of see as, well, the executive pushed a little boundary, the FISA court ran with it, and if the result is that Congress tweaks the law to comport with what we're doing for the reason that we're doing it, I would actually think of that as a good and salutary set of developments.
Although the only reason Congress would be in a position to tweak what we're doing one way or the other is that there was an illegal disclosure of the program, right? So So if not for the illegal disclosure by Snowden, we'd never know about this. This would all just be going on in secret.
So correct with a few caveats. One is that the government has been a bit more open about this than people understand. In public testimony in 2009, Todd Hinnan, who was then the policy deputy at NSD at the Justice Department, was asked about library records and Section 215, and described how 215 was used. And he said basically it's used to acquire individual records and sets of records. It's never been used to acquire library data. It is used to support a major covert action program that I can't discuss in a public setting, but we've briefed you on that separately.
And therefore Congress knew.
And
we all did.
I'm not saying either Congress institutionally knew or we all knew, but there have been a number of, so that was the most public. The executive made, first of all, briefed the intelligence committees capaciously. So the portions of Congress that are delegated to oversee these programs, absolutely knew, and I don't think there's any dispute about that. In 2010, the administration gave the intelligence committees a set of reports on this stuff and asked that they be made available to all members of Congress, which they were in both houses.
Can I ask a quick question? Yeah. When you say made available, is that made available just to the members of Congress or to the senators, or is that made available to the staff? Because with all respect to senators and members of Congress, they're generalists. They look at a 80-page document citing statutes, and they have no idea what it means, right? So did the staff look at it? Was it sort of analyzed at the staff level, or did they just sort of show senators, say, here's the 80-page document?
And where was it available?
It was available in a facility by the intelligence committees. Look, there's no question that large numbers of people do not avail themselves of its availability. I believe that staff were not given access to it. And so I'm not saying, you know, every member knew everything. I am saying that the limiting factor in 2010, at least, on what members knew as a general matter was how actively involved they chose to be, rather than what information was available to them. Now, 2011 is a slightly different story. The executive branch did exactly the same thing. It made a significant document available to both intelligence committees. The Senate made it available to all members. The House Intelligence Committee did not. And so I think there is an argument that certain House members who were new in 2011 may not have had the benefit of as much information, and it is certainly true that members often do not do their homework. And so I have no doubt that there are a lot of members who were surprised. The question is, whose fault is that?
I want to go back to Ben's point about how the relevant issue is necessity. I think this may be the place where Ben and I disagree the most, because I think the problem with arguments grounded in necessity is that courts are really bad at measuring necessity. I mean, how many of you guys have read Korematsu at some point in your law school lives? Really? Or you just deny it? You know, it's all haze. How many of you should have read Korematsu at some point? Yeah. So the whole point of Justice Jackson's dissent in Korematsu is that courts suck at necessity, right? That if you ask them whether things are legal, they can handle. If you ask them whether things are necessary, they actually really have no idea what they're doing. And Korematsu proves the point. I mean, in Korematsu itself, the military's representation to the Supreme Court was that mass suspicionless detention was necessary, and that they did not have the capability, the institutional capacity to do individualized assessments of dangerousness. That turned out to be a misrepresentation for which the Solicitor General actually apologized 2 years ago. Leaving aside the history, the statute doesn't say necessary. Right? I mean, the statute Congress wrote in 2001 says relevant. It says...
Although the case law on relevance... The statute says it needs to be a circumstance in which a subpoena would be issued in a criminal case. that case law ends up then hinging on necessity.
That's so right.
There is a doctrinal reason.
There's a doctrinal head. I worry there's a doctrinal head to necessity. I just don't think that that's a dispositive question, right? And the reason why I worry about that being a dispositive question is that, I mean, it's Ben's first point about needles and haystacks, right? If you create a haystack of all data that is compiled in any database anywhere in the world, I will guarantee you it is relevant. Right? I will guarantee you that that database will be relevant to terrorism investigations, and I will guarantee you that the government will be able to even prove to all of our satisfaction that that data is necessary to further their ability to deter future acts of terrorism. That can't be the only consideration, right? And the reason why that can't be the only consideration is because the whole purpose of the Fourth Amendment was to prohibit what were called general warrants, right? And if everything is necessary, then we're back to a regime where what Section 215 is really authorizing is something very much tantamount to a general warrant for all data everywhere in the world. So the question is, what's the limiting principle?
So I want to turn, your question goes in two different directions. I'm going to pick one of them, and then we'll come back to the other one in a minute. To the policy question, which is, let's assume we can wipe the slate clean and we can come up with whether we want the government to have this sort of program or not. It seems to me that from at least an outside perspective, one really important question is, does this work? So the defenses of the Section 215 program really hinge on the idea that we absolutely need this information in order to track the terrorist groups and see all their communications. And that raises the question of, will you absolutely need this as compared to what? What is the alternative regime that you could have in which the government doesn't get automatic bulk access to everything? And when you say that one program is necessary and is really significant, how well is it working as compared to what alternative? And that as members of the public, without the access to the underlying classified information, I don't think we really have any way of answering that question. So to some extent, we're stuck. And we're stuck sort of we're blind, right? We have no idea how to respond when the government says, this is really important, this works really well. We don't have any information. I guess the government has said that there was one case where it helped them find...
Well, first they said 53.
First they said many, then they said, trying to figure out how useful this is. And I imagine one of the difficulties in making numbers out of this is that it's not like you enter in a query into this database and like out pops a terrorist profile and they say the terrorist is 8 blocks down the road and you should arrest him in apartment 2C.
Abu Nazir is in the United States.
Instead it's going to be, maybe here are the people that you look at and these people seem to be ones that other people of suspicion are also talking to, and so maybe you should take a look at this person. So I just wonder, how do we determine what works here in order to know what the government should be doing? And alternatively, is this just a conundrum that we can't answer? Are we either we trust the government to tell us what works, or we don't trust them, and legislation is ultimately made by just counting the people who trust and the people who don't trust?
So, I mean, Oren, it seems like there are a couple of possible ways to think about responding to that, right? So the first is to say, okay, let's assume we agree with the government based on everything we know in public, right? Are there ways to provide them with access to the same data short of this, short of the bulk metadata program, right? So one of the proposals that's being floated out there is to impose mandatory data retention requirements on all the private entities who could be the recipients of 215 order or 702 certifications. So they keep it in a locked drawer somewhere until the government comes along and says, we actually have reasonable articulable suspicion that justifies us querying this data that's in your possession, right? So make a sort of a firmer line between public and private. But even if you're not sure about that, or even if you think that's not enough, another possibility is to say, you're right, we're the public, we're dumb, right? We can't know everything. Let's empower the oversight mechanisms, right? Let's empower the accountability mechanisms. Let's empower the FISA court. And I think that's part of why we've seen so far in the conversations for reform so much interest not just in sort of adjusting the 215 and 702 authorities, but also interest in changing the role of the FISA court, in giving it more of an ability to have adversarial presentation, in providing more parties with an opportunity to appear before the FISA court. Because even if we can't have this public policy debate, let's at least make it easier for the people who are supposed to be doing it to do it.
I wonder, though, how can the courts do this? So So courts are set up to hear adversarial cases involving some sort of ex post challenge, right? Typically, certainly in the Fourth Amendment area or in the criminal law context, we have public authorities where it's clear what the general powers are of the government. And then the government applies those authorities and says, we think we can do this. Plaintiff or criminal defendant comes into court and says, you broke the law, and then the court adjudicates that. And courts are good at that ex post single case litigation. How can a court answer a programmatic question of, you know, is this program working? Is this a good policy to have? Is the government generally following the law? I don't understand how a court can answer that programmatic question. So I'm skeptical that I support some of the FISA court reforms. I just don't know if the FISA court can really solve these problems.
You know, I mean, let me be clear. I don't think a court can solve everything, right? And a court can never say this is a good idea, this is a bad idea. But imagine a world where, you know, in 2006 or 7, whenever the government first started offering this interpretation of Section 215, right, you actually had a party who received a 215 order represented in court, right, showing up to challenge the FISA court's decision, appealing an adverse decision in the FISA court of review, and then petitioning for certiorari off of that. Right? I mean, I think, you know, then we would have at least had some settling of the legal question, which would have better informed, then Congress could have come back and said, no, we actually really did mean for 215 to encompass things like telephony metadata, right? So I'm not saying courts are in a position to resolve these issues, but I think we can better empower the FISA court to help Congress, right, and to, if it's a statutory question, and help the Supreme Court if it's a constitutional question, right? Because I think the problem is the sort of the one-sided nature of the information flow. Right, and the one-sided nature of the sort of disclosures, at least up until the summer, where the FISA court was basically, you know, operating as totally in the dark on what the opposing viewpoints were. So, no, I mean, is this working is only a question the government can answer, but at least the pressure of more rigorous judicial review might prompt the government to want to make a more complete defense, a more complete explanation, a more complete argument in support of that view.
So I actually disagree with almost every component of that. I'm going to return at some point to all the many things, because it's actually most of the stuff that Steve and I actually agree on. We never talk about the stuff we agree on, but we actually agree on a lot in this. But for now, I just want to say...
You're also mad at the Giants?
I'm also mad at the Giants. Look, first of all, the question of does it work is... It's a profoundly difficult question, not just for the government to answer, but for anybody to answer. And there's a reason for that, which is that the way intelligence collection works, as Oren alluded before, is you almost never have but-for causation. You have data streams. These are entities that are in the business of stealing secrets from people and sometimes compelling people to produce secret information. They have these streams of data that come in. And they throw them all in a pot, and they stir them around, and then they try to make sense of the soup. And the soup, at the end of the day, may taste good. You know, you catch a real bad guy, or you stop a really bad thing from happening. But figuring out exactly what the role of the carrot was in how the soup tastes is really hard. And so when you ask the government which good outcomes did 215 data play a role in, they can produce 50 some odd cases where, from their point of view, 215 data is one of the streams that helps produce a very positive outcome. And they look at that and they say, hey, that's great, that's a really productive stream. But if you ask somebody who's a critic of the program and you say, well, what role, they'll turn around and say, well, what role did 215 data play in that? And the answer is, well, it helped us do this and it helped us do this. Would you have gotten to the same result anyway? Maybe. And how many cases can you say there's really something close to but-for causation with respect to 215 data? Probably one. It's a big one. But there are not very many of them. If you talk to people, you know, at FBI or NSA, what they'll say is that's not the way we work. Now I don't know how you translate. You know, so if you're looking for whether you're the FISA court or the Congress or the public, and you're looking for the magic answer to the question, does it work? I think that's not the question the intelligence community is asking themselves. They're asking themselves a much nerdier and weirder question, which is it useful, is it productive? The way they measure the productivity of streams, again, it's totally unsatisfying from a should we be collecting this point of view. They say, how often does this data stream produce information that we report? I.e., our job is to produce, you know, reported intelligence product. How often is this data showing up, and do we consider it useful enough to report to our clients? Now, again, if you're a hardcore civil libertarian, you say, well, that's not a very high standard. And it's not. These guys aren't in the business of figuring out how useful is useful enough. That's sort of a policy judgment. And I don't really know how you square that circle, but I don't think the FISA court is a likely place to do it.
But I guess I don't know if I count as a hardcore civil libertarian, right? I mean, all I'm trying to say is how useful enough is not what Section 215 says. And so if you want a world where that's the relevant standard, fine, write a statute that says that.
Well, that's kind of what I just said, right? What I said is if you're the government and you're trying to operate under 215, you make an argument based on relevance. But you're going to make a lot of people uncomfortable based on that. And I would personally be more comfortable if you had a statute that A, authorized the collection directly, and B, did it on the basis of something that was more the way I feel, the reason I think we all feel that, or some of us feel that this material should be collected. One point on necessity. So I don't think necessity deserves quite the bad rep that you give it when you note that Korematsu was done in the name of necessity. Any time you do strict scrutiny, you're really asking a necessity question. Is this reasonably tailored to something really compelling? Is it narrowly tailored to a really compelling interest, right? And I think the question, you could write a statute that asks a similar question about bulk metadata. If you can show that the acquisition of all the blank type data in the world is narrowly tailored to a really compelling counterterrorism or a really compelling national security interest, you can do it. If you can't show that, you can't do it.
That would be awesome. Let me focus again, though, a little bit on the policy question. Just do we want to have this program? Ben, you suggested that the intelligence agencies, they don't focus on does it work, they focus on does it produce actionable intelligence or something?
Does it work in abstraction from other streams?
Yeah, and let's even accepting that as the standard. My concern is, let's say there were better programs that we could have, or let's say that it's working a little bit, but it's not worth its cost. would the intelligence agencies ever just sort of come forward and say, we spent the last 9 years with this program, and we have however many thousands of employees that work on this, we just don't think it's really panning out. We think on the whole, this just isn't worth the cost. Our job, we could probably do a decent enough job, maybe 90% of what we do, with a quarter of the employees and with a much lower civil liberties risk, so let's do that. It just seems to me unlikely that the intelligence agencies are going to come forward with that information. And if so, it means that we have the government saying, we need to do this, and most everyone else saying, okay, well, if the government really thinks we need to do this, then we should do it, without anyone ever stepping back and saying, what works? If you could start from scratch and design the best procedure, whether on the basis of cost, whether on the basis of balancing civil liberties and government power, right? We never get to that point. We just sort of end up with whatever program has been created ends up just ongoing just because it's there and the government says they need it.
So two things on that front. One is the government did discontinue bulk collection of internet metadata, and which was also proceeding. And so the history of discontinuing things because in the cost benefit of civil liberties, productivity, legality, things work out to be at sometimes, you know, gee, maybe we shouldn't keep doing this. I don't want to overstate that point.
Since I think it might also have something to do with 702.
I don't know what it is. All I know is we used to have a bulk metadata program for internet, and we don't have one anymore. And I don't want to overstate the point because I do think government programs always tend to see their perpetuation as a positive good all the time. And if your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So I don't want to overstate the point. And I do think anytime you're operating in the covert arena, there is a bigger risk that there's nobody there to say, gee, the emperor has no clothes here. This really isn't worth it. So you build surrogates. You build the FISA court, which, yes, it has its problems. It is an outside voice. You build the intelligence committees, which, yes, they have their problems. They are an outside voice. And yes, every now and then, somebody comes along and commits a criminal act that may have devastating operational consequences, or may not, and that provokes a public debate that is in and of itself salutary. I don't really know what the alternative to that is, except that I agree with Steve and Oren that there are a set of things that you could do to make these oversight processes more robust.
Well, and one of the things you could do, I think, so this conversation is often presented in the press as a choice between two, you know, diametrically opposed alternatives, collect everything or collect nothing. And I think that's unfortunate because I don't think there's actually almost anyone who ascribes to either pole, right? The other way to think about this conversation is, you know, all right, let's have a frank conversation about shifting our focus from collection to use, right? That if the government's position is that they really do have to collect all this information, fine, let's impose far more rigorous constraints on their ability to use the data, right? I mean, so just to get, I mean, this has been made at this point already, right? But, you know, if the government's collecting all the metadata, you could impose by statute, right, a requirement that they have to have, you know, reasonable suspicion before they ever query the metadata for any U.S. person's information.
Which the FISA court has imposed as a matter of minimization, but the statute does not say.
Statute doesn't say a word about it,
yeah,
right?
Because they never contemplated anything like this in the first place, presumably.
Arguably, right? There's people might disagree, but that's the point, right? Which is that, you know, this conversation is not, you know, choice A, let them do everything they want, choice B, let them do nothing. And what's frustrating from my perspective is that for so long, because we've known so little about this process, right, you know, that's all we've understood it to be. When in fact, there are plenty of reasonable people who disagree with each other, who could, I think, find middle ground where there are ways of better reconciling these really absolute tensions. You know, on the one hand, the government would be in better position from an intelligence perspective to have every piece of information they could ever have. On the other hand, we have a Fourth Amendment, and we have at least some expectation of privacy. And so somewhere in the middle, there has to be some kind of balance.
So this is actually, it's a good moment, actually, to focus on the areas of agreement here, which everybody elides, but they're actually quite significant. So nobody, you know, within the universe of the same, from quite far left to quite far right, it's a right-left spectrum is a weird beast here, because for reasons Steve has written about, but from quite civil libertarian to quite enthusiastic about surveillance powers, let's put it that way. Everybody agrees that you know, we have an intelligence community whose job it is to collect intelligence. Nobody thinks that that's a process that you can do in public. Everybody agrees that that process should be governed by a statutory law that is significantly more restrictive in some ways than the constitutional law, and everybody agrees that there should be oversight mechanisms that are significant, although not entirely public. And what we're really arguing about is, you know, very important set of details within that wide structure of agreement. But I don't think, you know, I think within the confines of the belief that we're going to be collecting a lot of intelligence and that involves a lot of data, there's actually not as much room for policymaking and as the debate sometimes suggests.
I wanted to turn now to the other aspect that Steve had suggested, that of the Fourth Amendment, and push back, Steve, on your Fourth Amendment discussion, having spent a little bit of time with that particular amendment myself. And that is, under current law, it seems to me that the government is correct that metadata is not protected under Smith versus Maryland and similar cases, and that the phrase expectation of privacy gets kind of thrown around a lot, almost as kind of a policy matter, that this is a policy debate of constitutional dimensions, and therefore we should take it more seriously, which is common in sort of American political discourse. Nobody ever wants to say, I think it's a bad idea. People want to say it's unconstitutional. It sort of makes it like, not only is it a bad idea, it's like an un-American bad idea. But it seems to me that under Smith versus Maryland, the case on pen registers from 1979, and more recent cases involving cell phone metadata from the Fifth Circuit and other cases, the Ninth Circuit's case on internet metadata, that as a matter of current law, that the courts, the FISA court and other courts have been incorrect, and the government has been correct in saying that this is not a constitutional question. And so that really, I think, to my mind, leaves us in a pure policy zone. And I guess the tension there is how much can be made public about the government's surveillance practices in order to allow some sort of a public feedback that would allow the democratic process to work. So the democratic process requires feedback. We need to know what's happening in order to know whether to amend the law to allow a certain program, or you know, do we want to cut back on something or expand something. We generally need some feedback, and here we've gotten no feedback except for the disclosures, or very little feedback except for the Snowden disclosures, which tell us about what the government was doing in some surprising ways. And I wonder, you know, can the FISA court, you know, one answer would be for the FISA court to make public its disclosures of how it's interpreting the law, sort of maybe release, not only, I'm not thinking a redacted opinion, but like a one-paragraph summary that says, we issued an opinion, a syllabus, we issued an opinion interpreting the following word in FISA to mean the following. And so that would be no disclosure of any operative facts. It wouldn't tell you anything about the case. It wouldn't tell you about the specific legal arguments that were made. It would just be kind of the holding of the case. Think of it, in this audience might appreciate, like a case brief of what's the holding of this case, just tells you what the interpretation is of the courts to then give you some idea as to what the executive branch is going to do in light of this opinion. And I don't know why the FISA court couldn't do that. It seems to me that that would give the feedback needed to give us some idea as to what's happening.
So the tech investors, they can't do it because their rules currently don't allow them to, right? I mean, the Rule 62 of the FISA court's rules have a sort of a binary on or off switch for publication. You can publish the opinion or you can't, right? So, but that would be an easy amendment to the rules.
Yeah.
Imagine Marbury versus Madison presented to you in a one paragraph blurb, right? You know, the court in this case interpreted the original jurisdiction clause of Article 3 to not allow Congress to expand this court's jurisdiction to encompass original writs of mandamus, period.
Well, but that's better than not hearing about Marbury versus Madison at all, right?
Oh, I agree. No, I agree that it's better than nothing.
A raw holding at least tells you, I mean, it almost sort of defines the term, right? It tells you this is what this program is roughly doing, even though it doesn't give you any of the good detail.
Like the theory of judicial review that underlines all of our constitutional law, right? Well, no, that's right. I mean, I think, so let me just sort of, lest this be taken as disagreement. I think, you know, requiring the FISA court to issue an unclassified summary of any, and the current language in the various bills floating around Congress is significant interpretation, you know, of the statutes charged is a great idea. I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea at all. I don't know that it would impel the kind of reform we'd want without someone who's actually in a position to know more, right? And this is why I think we've seen pressure in many of the reforms floating around Congress right now for something akin to a special advocate or a public interest advocate. I think one of the bills calls it the public interest constitutional advocate, because if you have enough words, it'll sound fancy. Right? But the idea is that you'd have someone whose job it was to be that person in the FISA court, sort of, you know, knowing how the sausage is getting made, right? And in a position not just to push back in the FISA court, but also to report to Congress, and to use their expertise in proceeding before the FISA court to flip that over and, you know, sort of brief the FISA court. I think that would help at least the statutory side of the conversation. I don't know that it would bear on the constitutional side, unless you also empowered this person to appeal adverse decisions, so that if and when the Supreme Court were inclined to revisit the staples of Fourth Amendment doctrine, and we know from Jones, for example, that at least Justice Sotomayor, you know, thinks it might be time to rethink Smith. I mean, she's all alone on that, but at least that's one. Right, that now you'd also be providing access to the Supreme Court if it wanted to do the same kind of work constitutionally. So I think you're right, and I think there are ways to do it. I think that's part of why we're seeing, you know, in the Blumenthal, Udall, Wyden bill that was introduced yesterday, not yesterday, today, some of this push.
Sorry, I was just adding money to my parking meter. I'm successful.
Can't the NSA do that for you?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk while you add?
No. Okay. So I think that it is certainly a good idea to have more adversarial process in the FISA court, where possible. I also think it is a very good idea to publish FISA court opinions where possible. I think the universe of the where possible here, it may be more limited than we would think. And I don't say that with any, you know, joy in my heart or anything. So consider the 215 program as an example. I think it's probably, not that I think there are a lot of 215-like programs, but I think it's probably a fairly typical example. If you say from the initial disclosure that the program exists is the damage. And so the day that Snowden blows the program, the president can say, okay, I'm ordering that we release as much as we can on this. The marginal damage of the subsequent disclosures is much less than the initial disclosure of the fact of the program. So if you map that on to these two, particularly the publication of the FISA court opinions, you know, figuring out how to publish something without disclosing the fact of the subject of the thing is extremely difficult. And you actually, it's a bit of a puzzle how you do that, how you create the transparency without paying the costs of the transparency. One interesting data point there is that the critics of the program who were on the Intelligence Committee, Udall and Wyden, both of whom are extremely capable and very able people who really understand the details of this program, they had a device at their disposal, which they never used, to describe this program and the holding of the FISA court, which was introduced legislation reversing it. Right? They could have introduced legislation saying 215 does not authorize the acquisition of bulk metadata. They never did it. And I believe that the reason that they never did it, you'd have to ask them, but I believe that the reason that they never did it is that you couldn't do that, i.e. reverse the mere legal holding of the FISA court without significantly compromising the program. And so what did they do instead? But Wyden made a speech, series of speeches, where he said the public would be outraged if it knew the way this law was being interpreted. But he did not say how the law was being interpreted. And I think it's very, very difficult to compel, unless you simply decide in advance that you're going to pay the cost and not have covert programs. It's very hard to do that, you know, to have an ex ante rule compelling the summarizing of or publication of opinions.
Although, doesn't that depend on how specific a level of generality you're thinking of in terms of transparency? So, for example, I think we would all agree it doesn't raise major problems to say there is a surveillance program. It involves telephones. That I think everyone would get. It would be troubling if it were down to the detail of it is monitoring the following person.
And then there's lots of levels of generality between that. So I don't know why, you know, explaining the legal holding of the court in terms of what it said a particular word means, yes, you'd then use that to figure out the general characteristics of what program may exist. But isn't that exactly the level of disclosure that the legislative process would ordinarily be expected to provide?
Well, so it would be an interesting question. How would you, I mean, you know this area of law better than anybody. How would you describe the Fisk order so as to be informative, but so as not to say what was going on?
Well, it depends on what you mean, what was going on. But you could say the word relevant in the statute includes bulk collection at any scale.
But at some level, if I had read that, and I think if you had read that 6 months ago, we would have said that means you can get 10 records, not just one.
Well, at any scale, which could be, or you could say including nationwide.
Or the word relevance means, you know, the same thing the court has interpreted it to mean in this other statute, right? Say the grand jury subpoena statute, right? I mean, a statute that simply said we amend section 215 to clarify our understanding of relevance to reflect the same standard that is enmeshed in this other statute would tell no one anything about what the FISA court had said or about the programs that it was supervising.
So look, I don't doubt that you.
Right.
Well, you know. I don't know, since presumably the government's position is that they could have done this with a grand jury subpoena.
No, but I'm not...
Right, it's the implication of the record.
Right,
which is one of the disturbing implications, right.
But my point is just that, right, I mean, my point is just that, like, it's a false dichotomy again, right, that it's sort of a, you know, because we can't do everything, we must do nothing. And I think the problem is that that's just not true, right, because in this context, you could have tried to find other statutory definition of relevance. You could have tried to find other ways of empowering more oversight. I mean, I agree, Wyden and Udall could have done more. I'm just saying, like, I don't think it's quite as obvious that the second they opened their mouths, you know, they would have been snowed to the punch.
So let me ask you, let me propose a different way of maybe accomplishing a similar objective.
Have a special advocate before the FISA court?
No. I mean, specifically with respect to publication of opinions. You know, OLC has a default rule that they publish opinions of OLC unless they don't. So, it's first of all, there's the question of the default rule, which is the FISA court's default rule is we don't publish opinions. The low-hanging fruit is change the default rule to we do publish opinions. Now, if you do that, the FISA judges will write their opinions differently. And Judge Egan's opinion, which, you know, both of my co-panelists have criticized a lot, is notable in one very non-legal sense, which is it required almost no redactions. And the reason it required almost no redactions is that she wrote it knowing it was going to be made public, and you write it differently under those circumstances, and the government briefs things differently under
those circumstances. Indeed, the most redacted thing in the opinion is the name of her own prior opinion.
Right. When you don't write it, so the default rule really matters, and I think that's a really easy low-hanging fruit. Second, if the Attorney General decides that the opinion can't be made public, you could make that opinion available to all members of Congress. You could not do it in an easy fashion. We'll send it over to every one of your offices. It would require a certain degree of engagement on the part of the members of Congress, but you could do it.
Okay, we are unfortunately out of time. Do we have any time for audience questions? Let's do that. You may have questions. Just about 5 minutes or 10 minutes of questions. If you need to go, feel free to go. Since I said I think we were originally supposed to be ending at 5, but we got a late start. So any questions?
I'm not entirely familiar with how familiar our panelists are with government contracts, but in government contracts, you have protective orders, and I was wondering if anybody was thinking that might be something that might be feasible, as you have, say, a security clearance vetted bar for FISA courts that
that could represent people who have been subject to an issue at Innocent. And that way you would not have the information conveyed to the subject necessarily, but you would be able to have representation who would be pre-cleared to have that information made available for the purpose of having an adversary in the process.
Yeah, let me just quickly repeat the question for the audio. So the question ultimately is, what about the role of protective orders and having a bar that's clear to litigate these issues before the FISC? Absolutely. So there's attorneys that litigate before the FISC now, and there are attorneys that have security clearances, and there are a lot of lawyers in this town that have security clearances that are able to do this sort of work, including former government lawyers. So there's lots of attorneys that are there to make the argument if the structure is there to have to make it.
Well, indeed, and we know for a fact that there are attorneys for Yahoo who appeared before the FISA court and the FISA court review in 2008. And so, not only is there, there are actually lots of precedent in other contexts, government contracts, the Guantanamo habeas cases, where the attorneys all have security clearances and can't communicate information to the court. But there's actually, precedent in the FISA court itself, which is one of the things I was trying to say about 215 and 702, that they built in this possibility. And so one of the, I think, the most common central forms is to just expand that.
You had mentioned earlier that one of the possibilities might be to have companies retain certain sets of information for a certain number of years. Is that better than having the government do it? I mean, the idea that Verizon is going to protect that same treasure trove of data better than the NSA is hard for me to believe. I mean, at the end of the day, you either are upset that someone's collecting data or not. I mean, why would we want private companies to do this?
May I address that briefly? So I actually think of all the ideas that have floated around for solving this problem, the requirement, and this is what European governments do, by the way, is a retention requirement with respect to the telecom carriers. I think it's a terrible idea for a few reasons. One is you would then have multiple companies retaining this data rather than one
government.
One government that, however flawed the accountability mechanisms are, does have certain democratic accountability mechanisms. Secondly, you would have to impose use requirements. One of the threshold reasons why, in Smith v. Maryland, this stuff was deemed to be is that companies are retaining it for their own business purposes anyway. And so rather than having one entity that's using it only for counterterrorism purposes, you would have multiple entities that are using it for large numbers of purposes of their own.
Which they're already doing.
Well, except that the reason the government collects the stuff is that these companies don't retain them. And so if you now require them to retain them, you would have to then figure out how to prevent them from figuring out what else they can do with it. And I think that there's something, frankly, more attractive about the idea of saying, let's have the government have it for one narrow purpose rather than multiple actors keeping it for whatever purposes they want, and then try to restrict those purposes.
Except we know that the government's not using it for one narrow purpose. I mean, the Lovett, right, story, I mean, the government, whether it's government policy or not, the existence of the government's database empowers government employees, whether acting under authority or acting ultra vires, to use the data for all kinds of nefarious purposes. And so the biggest difference to me between having having Verizon, Facebook, Twitter, and Google separately keep your information about those four things, and having the government keep one database is, yes, they will use that information for lots of purposes, and yes, you may not like all those purposes, but they only have the data you're giving to them, right? They can't tell the complete story of your life the way that the government with the ability to actually aggregate those databases can. And for Ben's concern that these companies might use this data for problematic purposes, how about some privacy laws? I mean, there are ways to fix that. So I don't know that it's nearly as problematic as Ben suggests.
All right, we are out of time. It's been a terrific panel. Join me in thanking our panel.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.